This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, the part of the program which we call the Big Picture. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you.
The medicine away, what happens is that patient goes through withdrawals. We're going to start seeing these global economies go through some volatility. That is the withdrawal part of it. Now, the bottom line, though, is that what we're looking at is a situation, and Rick Santelli has been talking about it time and time again, that you've got one-third of the sovereign debt controlled by the central banks. This is a manipulated market. If we had one-third of any market controlled by any entity, we would be talking about it as if it were a monopoly of some sort. So what we really need to do is to understand that this Fed is now draining the system. The central banks around the world are ready to drain. And if that's taking place, then we have to be prepared for it. And as Ray Dalio was saying, we got to be very, very close to the exits. Look, you know, this market's gone up 20%. You can't go broke taking a profit.
Well, when the world's leaders, or at least those leaders of the world's largest hedge funds, speak, people tend to listen. That was on CNBC, Jack Barugian talking about Ray Dalio. Ray Dalio heads up Bridgewater, the world's most successful hedge fund manager, and his article on LinkedIn that there is a regime change coming to the financial system, noting that the era of easy money is coming to an end.
Yeah, that comment that Barugian was commenting on is in the LinkedIn article. Ray Dalio said, you know, we need to still keep dancing, but closer to the exit door. And that was a reference to the infamous comment made by Chuck Prince at Citibank talking about before the housing crisis. He goes, look, the music's still playing, so we got to keep dancing. Well, Dalio is saying is we need to keep dancing. We just need to keep closer to the exit door. So translation, what was Dalio really saying? The keep dancing part was referring to that the markets can still keep going up. I mean, people thought stocks were crazy in 1997, but they went up for another 3 years before the tech bubble burst. So that's why Dalio is saying there, hey, look, this isn't over. It can still go on much further than you think. Secondly, he was also saying by keeping close to the exit door, he's saying we're probably closer to the end of this bull market, which is now in its ninth year. In another comment that he made, he said, and speaking of that exit door, we need to be mindful of the tea leaves. Well, exactly what are those tea leaves? He's talking about inflation. Now, why would that be important? If inflation starts to heat up, what do central banks do? They get more aggressive in their rate hikes. So far, since 2013, it's taken the Fed 4 years to raise interest rates four times. And the Central Bank of Canada, as John Ng and I talked about in hour one, just raised interest rates for the first time since 2010. And so central banks are likely to take their time raising interest rates. It's only when inflation begins to heat up, as it did between 2005 and 2007, that they keep raising and raising to the point they finally break something. And then the third thing you need to keep an eye on is the credit markets, because right now credit spreads have narrowed. And when trouble first starts to surface, think back in 2006, the credit markets started to get into trouble, which led to trouble with financial firms, beginning with Bear Stearns in 2007, all the way to the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers that basically created that domino effect and daisy chain that nearly brought down the financial system. So Dalio was saying three things with that comment. And why people pay attention to him. Not only does he manage the world's largest hedge fund, he is probably the most successful hedge fund manager with a long-term track record. So he's basically saying, look, stocks in this market continue to go up. And that's what his reference was made and what he meant by, we got to keep dancing. Secondly, his reference to the exit door is a reference that we're closer to the end of the bull market than we are in the middle or the beginning. And third, keep a close eye on the tea leaves is basically saying when you need to exit or get close to that exit door and walk out, these are the things you should really be looking for. Inflation, the leading economic indicators, and the credit markets. And it's not just the Federal Reserve now. All the central banks, and this is what Dalio was also referring to when he says there's a regime change coming, it's not just the Fed anymore. This week, the Central Bank of Canada raised interest rates the first time since 2010. The ECB is talking about taper, cutting back on its buying of bonds, and we'll talk about the implications of that. Other central banks, like the Bank of China, are tightening. So here we are this week. The Bank of Canada tightened and raised interest rates a quarter of a point, which doesn't seem like much, from 50 basis points to 75, or a half a percent to three quarters. But it's the first time they've done so since 2010. Canada is now the second central bank behind the Federal Reserve to raise rates as stronger economic activity picks up in Canada. The ECB is also indicating it is moving towards tapering and its withdrawal of stimulus by buying bonds every single month.
And Jim, as Janet Yellen reiterated this week, and we've been talking about it here on the program for some time, it could begin as soon as September, the Federal Bank, in shrinking its balance sheet, and they've indicated they're going to continue to raise interest rates. There is no talk of pausing, no stopping or waiting to see how things are doing. They're going to plug ahead with their agenda here.
I see the risk with respect to inflation as being two-sided, and with respect to how that bears on policy, most of my colleagues and I, when we looked at this matter in June, even recognizing that we've had several months of low inflation readings and that we're focused on trying to understand it, have felt that it probably remains prudent to continue on a gradual path of rate increases. But it's something we will watch very carefully. And I want to emphasize that monetary policy is not something that's set in stone. And if our evaluation changes with respect to inflation, that will make a difference.
That was Janet Yellen testifying on Capitol Hill this week as everyone waited with bated breath for the testimony. Jim, how do we translate that, what she just said?
Basically, she said, we're going to keep tightening. And on top of that, we're going to begin reducing liquidity in the market. In other words, the Fed has not bought any bonds since it ended at the end of 2014. But what the Fed has done on a monthly basis is bonds and interest is earned on this $4.6 trillion expansion of their balance sheet. As that interest and those bonds mature, they just simply roll them over and buy new bonds. So every single month, the Fed is in the marketplace buying treasuries and buying mortgage-backed bonds. Now what they're saying, we're going to also raise interest rates, but instead of rolling over those bonds and going into the marketplace, we're going to stop doing that. We're going to reduce that. We're going to begin by $10 billion a month, and every quarter we will raise that by another $10 billion. So in the end, they will be reducing their balance sheet by $30 billion a month. And if you recall, when they began taper, they began it gradually, and then they increased it. The Fed is hoping to do the same thing as it begins to shrink its balance sheet. And what does that mean? That means that that money is no longer going into the marketplace, buying mortgage-backed securities, buying treasury bonds, which means there's one big buyer who's not in the marketplace anymore. And when you have the removal of one big buyer, what does that do? That means there's less people bidding for treasuries, which means the price of treasuries begin to rise. And as central banks begin this process, they do so, which is, this is what has puzzled a lot of people. They're doing so usually under unusual circumstances. Number one, economic growth has been sluggish. I mean, how many of you have heard numbers about 3 or 4% economic growth? We've heard it coming from the Fed and their forecast. Well, we've heard it from Wall Street. But the reality is we haven't had 3 to 4% economic growth. Economic growth has been nearly 1 or 2%. And secondly, central banks generally tend to get more aggressive when inflation is rising rapidly, as it was in 2007 when inflation was running at 5% annually. We're not even hitting the Fed's target of 2%. So the inflation rate is falling worldwide. And typically in past monetary cycles until this one, you normally see the economy overheat, as we saw in 2006 and 2007 or 1999 or 2000. And the second thing you generally see, as we did in 99 and 2007, is rising inflation. Well, that's not the world we live in today. We live in a world of weak and, at best, anemic economic growth, and right now, falling inflation.
Meanwhile, the economy appears to have grown at a moderate pace on average so far this year. Although inflation-adjusted gross domestic product is currently estimated to have increased at an annual rate of only 1.5% in the first quarter, more recent indicators suggest that growth rebounded in the second quarter. In particular, growth in household spending, which was weak earlier in the year, has picked up in recent months and continues to be supported by job gains, rising household wealth, and favorable consumer sentiment. In addition, business fixed investment has turned up this year after having been soft last year. And a strengthening in economic growth abroad has provided important support for U.S. manufacturing production and exports. The housing market has continued to gradually recover, aided by the ongoing improvement in the labor market and mortgage rates that, although up somewhat from a year ago, remain at relatively low levels. Well, let me state in the strongest possible terms, I agree that what you're showing here represents a trend that, given current spending and taxation decisions, is going to lead to an unsustainable debt situation with rising interest rates and declining investment in the United States that will further harm productivity growth and living standards. I believe a key thing that Congress should be taking into account in designing fiscal policy is the need to achieve sustainability of this debt path over time. This is something I'm not just saying today, but have been emphasizing for some time in my testimony.
Translation to what Janet Yellen just said there, the economy could probably use some stimulus, but keep an eye on how much stimulus, because there's a tremendous amount of debt out there.
And that's the one thing that I think that has puzzled so many people on Wall Street, including the Fed itself, is just as this has been an unusual monetary cycle, it has been different. It led to what we saw last summer, and we may even go there again, the lowest interest rates in recorded history. In fact, as we have argued on this program this year, what we've seen in the last 40 years has probably been the most unusual period in the financial markets in recorded human history. As I pointed out on an earlier program, you had to go back to the year 3000 BC to find interest rates at 20%. But that's exactly where they were in 1981. And from 1981, they went from 20% to a little over 1% last summer, and then negative percent is still exists today. There are many short-term bonds, sovereign bonds out there that you actually pay the government to loan them money. So just as this monetary cycle is different, as we've seen, the lowest interest rates in recorded history, the largest money printing in history, I forget what the figure is, I can't keep track of it, because it's still going on with the ECB and the Bank of Japan, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $15 trillion of money printing. And, as Janet Yellen just made reference to, the largest level of debt in history, with U.S. debt now $20 trillion, doubling under our last two presidents, both George W. Bush and Barack Obama. So just as that monetary cycle of lowering interest rates will be different, it will be different when we exit that low monetary policy. Central banks are proceeding, just like our Fed is now, at a very slow pace. Now remember, they announced in the spring of 2013 that they were going to start to gradually tighten by beginning cutting back on the amount of bonds that they were buying. The ECB is letting the markets know the same thing, that tapering is on its way and coming to Europe. So hence, what Dalio says, they're going to go at a slow pace, so you can still be out on the dance floor dancing. Now, if you think back, the last time the Fed began a rate-raising cycle was in 2004 under Greenspan. And it began in small incremental steps, quarter point at a time. None of the kind of stuff he was doing back in 1999 or in 1994 when he doubled the federal funds rate in a single year. In 1994, we went from 3 to 6% in 12 months. You'll never see that kind of action again, or at least unless we get into some kind of super high inflationary scenario. So the Fed is doing the same thing. They increased interest rates 0.25 point. They did that in December, and they've increased interest rates twice this year, March and June. So it took 3 years for the problems to surface in the last rate-raising cycle. The Fed began in 2004, but you didn't see problems begin to emerge until 2007, after the real estate market had already peaked in 2006, and the mortgage crisis that began at Bear Stearns, culminating with the bankruptcy in Lehman, Merrill Lynch, AIG, and other banking institutions in 2008. So we are, if you look at it, 4 years into this rate-raising cycle, which began with the announcement of taper in May of 2013. The Fed has raised interest rates 4 times.
And as you have so frequently pointed out here on the program, Jim, they keep raising rates. This is like their barometer, right? They keep raising rates until something breaks in the economy and then the financial markets. And it's very important to recognize that every recession and bear market since World War II has been preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle, which is where we are right now, and which is what Ray Dalio seems to be saying. Okay, the game is still going, the dance is still on, but edge your way over to the door in anticipation of the fact that it will come to an end. And by the way, this also has terrific impact usually in politics and in elections during the times of change that we anticipate seeing.
Well, and that's one thing we made in our forecast at the beginning of the year, our first show. We were saying that Donald Trump is probably the first president since George H. Bush that began his first year of presidency not with the economy in a recession as it was with George W. Bush or Barack Obama, and with the Fed not lowering interest rates and tightening. So Trump comes in and assumes the presidency in an aging business cycle, and at a time the Fed is raising interest rates. When you think back to George H. Bush, he became president in 1988, and we were already 8 years into the business cycle at that time. And then towards the end of his presidency, the Fed began raising interest rates. And of course, we got into the Gulf War, oil prices spiked, Fed was raising interest rates, and we got into a recession in 1991. So not since George H. Bush have we seen a president that has begun his first year in office with not only an aging business cycle, but also the Fed raising interest rates. So this cycle will proceed much slower than the previous rate raising cycle under Greenspan that ended with Bernanke. But at some point, and I don't know what that is, but I do not think the Fed will get anywhere near 3% Fed funds rate, or even a 4 or 5 as we did in the past, where it'll eventually lead to another crisis. But like 2004 and 2007 cycle, the question is, how will it end? What will precipitate it? Will it be some black swan? And as Yellen later clarified about her comment that we are unlikely to see another financial crisis in her lifetime, she also clarified it that you can't predict black swans when they occur, and some kind of shock to the system could bring about the next crisis.
And Jim, like all of those previous rollovers, whenever you had a loose era of monetary policy, it always created a bubble. And this is historic, just not going back between the last two times we've seen this, which was the tech bubble and the housing bubble. So if we have a bubble this time that's getting ready to roll over, where is it?
Well, it's like every loose monetary era, whether we were talking about the 80s, 90s, or even the 00 decade. In the 80s, it eventually led to a crisis in junk bonds, conglomerate stocks, real estate with the S&L crisis. 1999 and 2000, well, it was the internet bubble and tech stocks. In 2007 and 2009, it was real estate, mortgages, and stocks. Today, I believe the bubble is in what I call index funds and passive investing. And it was amazing because we did a show on this, I think it was on May 6th, where we did the next bubble. But Barron's also just did an article. It's the cover story, the recent cover of Barron's. And they were talking about the way the stock market has developed and the changes. There are now 6,000 different indexes that are out there. There's an index for everything around the globe. And you compare that to a decade ago when there were only 1,000 indexes. Meanwhile, the number of stocks that are traded publicly keeps shrinking as a result of mergers, bankruptcies, buyouts. There were 7,562 stocks a little over a decade ago. Today, there are 3,599 stocks. So the Wilshire 5000 index is no longer the Wilshire 5000 index. It is more concentrated. There are fewer stocks out there to trade today. And the money over the last couple of years has been going and coming out of active funds or ETFs into indexes, whether it's a mutual fund index that invests in the S&P, the NASDAQ, or the Dow, or ETFs that invest in various indexes. And just to give you an idea how big this is getting, according to Barron's, in the first 5 months of 2017, $338 billion is gone into index funds, and that compares to $506 billion, or over half a trillion dollars, that went into index funds last year. At the present rate of projection and tracking of money flows, over $800 billion could go into index funds this year, an increase of 60% from just last year alone. Passive indexes now represent nearly 60% of all equity assets. So in my opinion, if you want to know where the bubble is, it is in index funds and passive investing, and more recognition is being given to that, as evidenced by the recent cover story in Barron's highlighting some of the problems. If you take a look at most trading today on the stock exchange, only 10% of trading in stocks originates from some kind of fundamental discretionary trading. Most of this is taking place. It's either computerized trading or it's money that is being bought as fund money comes into these indexes. So every time $1 billion, or let's just make it easy mathematically, let's say $100 million comes into the Qs, or let's say a NASDAQ index fund, we know automatically out of that $100 million, $12 million automatically goes into Amazon. They don't even think. They just buy it. When you're an index fund, you don't pay attention to fundamentals. You don't pay attention to PE ratios or the price of what you're buying. The money comes in, you just have to buy whatever the index owns. If it's an S&P, you're going to buy the top FANG stocks. If it's a NASDAQ fund, you're going to buy the FANG stocks there as well. So the problem with passive index funds is they now have become the market because that's what they are. They buy the market. So passive funds buy index funds. They represent buying the stocks in the same proportion as the indexes they track. And the most important thing that Barron's was talking about, and we highlighted this in a program that we did a couple months ago, because when I began looking at these FANG stocks, and I was looking at Amazon, and I was thinking, who would pay 177 times earnings or 205 times earnings for Netflix or the other high PE ratios, very reminiscent of what we saw in the technology internet bubble in the late 90s. I said, who in their right mind would be doing that? Well, here's another thing that I found out. As I've started looking at this and I started looking at these stocks, I would look at the top 10 owners of these stocks. I don't care if it was Apple, Google, Netflix, or you're looking at Amazon, the top owners are all index funds. If you look at any stock today, I don't care if it's Exxon to Procter & Gamble to Coca-Cola, any kind of stock, the top 10 owners are index funds. It's no longer a hedge fund. It's no longer a particular mutual fund, an active mutual fund of a family. It is all ETF, index ETFs or index mutual funds. So in a bull market, the idea behind this passive investing is if the stock market is up 10%, you're an index fund, you capture 100% gains of the market itself. But here's the downside. In a down market or bear market, you capture and you suffer 100% of the downside. And let us not forget that between 2007 in March of 2009, the S&P 500 was down 58%. So if you were in an index fund, you were down 58% or more, counting the index fees. So this is also creating a problem with liquidity. And it's also highlighting volatility. People get scared. We have a lot of computer trading. Money goes in an index fund. Money comes out of an index fund. And that is moving stock prices back and forth, making them more volatile. So if indexes all own the same stock and money comes out of index funds, they're all selling the same stocks in the same quantity and the same percentages as they were doing when the money was coming in and they were buying those stocks. If you want to get into some of the detail, we really did an in-depth, deep dive of this. We did a show on May 6th, and we called it Inside the Bubble, where we detailed how indexing is driving the FANG stocks, the tech stocks, and valuations. So if you want to follow where that is in more detail, I highly recommend you go back to our May 6th program, which was called Inside the Bubble.
Yeah, but if we go back, Jim, and if we look at history, here's the pattern. Central banks attempt to tighten, and they announce it this way, at what they think is the right pace. But we all know that it always winds up with a problem because something, as you've frequently said for over the years, something always breaks. And so you can have a Goldilocks economy and market for some time, but not forever under these circumstances.
The problem, John, is monetary science is there's always a lag to anything the Fed does, whether they're lowering interest rates to stimulate the economy or they're tightening interest rates to slow the economy down. There's always a lag effect. And it's not precise. They don't know. It's kind of like the movie A Bridge Too Far about World War II. You don't know when it was a rate hike too far or a bond sell-off too far. We don't know that. They only know that in hindsight. And what will happen, and here's the big thing that's coming, central banks have been huge buyers. I mean, the Fed has bought $4.6 trillion of treasuries and mortgage-backed bonds. That was their effort to drive down long-term interest rates because they already drove down short-term interest rates to zero. But it was their bond buying that was trying to drive down long-term rates. What happens when they reverse that? What that means is as government debt is building and governments go into the marketplace to sell their bonds, central banks will no longer be the big buyers as they've been in this loose monetary regime that we've been involved in for the last 9 years. So that means the biggest buyer in the marketplace is now exiting the marketplace. What does that mean? Less buyers with more quantity. What will happen is the price will be driven down. In other words, interest rates will rise. And we're seeing that. And we've commented on the show. In 2008, the U.S. government spent $450 billion in interest on the national debt, which at that time was $10 trillion. In 2016, the national debt was $18.6 trillion, and the U.S. government spent only $430 billion in interest, meaning that the government had $8.6 trillion more debt than they did in 2010, but they spent $20 billion less in interest. Well, in fiscal year 2017, which began for the U.S. government last October, for the first time since 2008, interest costs are rising again, meaning that the government will spend more money on interest expense going forward at the same time that the debt continues to mount. And that's what Yellen was basically saying in that clip that we played here. Look, the economy probably needs stimulus because she knows the economy's weak. They also know that they're trying to normalize interest rates, which is raising interest rates, which means that's going to also raise the debt because it's going to cost the government more money when it finances its debt. With the Fed exiting the buying of shrinking its balance sheet, that means one less buyer. That's also going to drive the price up, and that will drive up the deficit. So this is why this comment of Dalio went ballistic, and a lot of people are talking about it because it was so reminiscent of what Chuck Prince said at Citigroup. Hey, we got to, as long as the music's playing, we got to keep dancing. What Dalio was basically saying, you got to keep dancing, look at the exit door, and then watch the tea leaves.
Well, speaking of tea leaves, as we move along here, whirling around the dancing floor and keeping our eyes on the door, what should we be looking for?
Well, I mean, we're seeing the classic signs everywhere we look that we're getting closer to the end. We're seeing elevated stock valuations. It's the second most expensive market in history. A flattening yield curve. The real danger comes when it inverts, meaning short-term rates are higher than long. We're seeing leveraged balance sheets still at the consumer level. The only thing that looks better is the price of assets have gone up. And we're also seeing leveraged balance sheets on corporations. We're also seeing an increasingly hawkish Fed. It's not just that they're talking about interest rates. They're also talking about allowing their bonds to lapse and shrink their balance sheet. And at the same time, we are seeing elevated margin levels for buying stocks. And so even though this is probably the most hated bull market in history, you have to understand this is a different bull market. It wasn't driven by investors going crazy and paying anything to own a stock. Most individuals have not been participating in this bull market. It's been mainly driven by almost $500 billion annually in stock buybacks and central banks buying stocks. So this has been an institutionally driven bull market. The markets are dominated today by computerized trading and the boom in index investing. So this is what I call a non-thinking market. When money goes into an index fund, there is no decisions to make. There is no evaluation to make. You don't look at PE ratios. You don't look at balance sheets. You just simply buy whatever is in the index. So this can go on, John. As Dalio said, we can keep dancing for a lot longer than most people think.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's always what I call the moment of jump off. So you're whirling around the dance floor. How close do you need to hang by the exit door? You know, I mean, because obviously, how do you move toward the exit door without making it look like it's a stampede at the same time?
Well, I mean, you should be de-risking at this time. And it's not just Ray Dalio that's talking about this. PIMCO, the world's largest bond fund manager, they were also featured in this week's Barron's. Their head investment analyst is saying, we're trimming our less liquid positions in the bond market. We're getting more defensive on their credit exposure and duration, meaning the average maturity in the portfolio that would be subject to interest rate risk. And as anytime you get to a Fed rate raising cycle, which leads eventually to a recession, what happens? Here are the tea leaves, folks. Credit spreads start to widen. And you watch where we are today. We have tight spreads, low yields, and extended equity valuations. So it is time to look at the exit doors. It is time to start building liquidity. And it is time to increase credit quality, decrease duration, and also decrease, or what I call de-risk, part of your portfolio. Because the day that when the music stops, you don't know what it's going to be. You don't know what event it's going to be. It can come out of nowhere, and that was one of the things that Yellen tried to clarify this week after her comments last week that, hey, we'll never see another financial crisis. But then she kind of put a hedge in there and a little caveat. Well, we could get a black swan out of nowhere that could emerge in a shock, which could take us into the next bear market or recession.
So in the words of Ray Dalio, as we wrap out this segment of the program, yes, we have to keep dancing in order to do something, but understand the music is going to stop, so you just made a way slide over to the door and keep twirling over there until it does. We'll be back in just a second as Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
When central banks are tightening, there's less tolerance for mistakes. So if you own a company that's not going to make their numbers or is at best going to meet them or is going to have guidance that's not up to high expectations, there's no room for error going into this earnings season. I used to give the example that when QE is on, it puts beer goggles on investors, makes everything look great. Now that we're approaching QT, rising interest rates, a tapering of overseas balance sheets, I think those beer goggles are beginning to clear up, and there's going to be very little tolerance for mistakes in second quarter earnings season. So I think that's what people should be really paying attention to over the next month.
Well, Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. I love technology. Well, let me clarify that, Jim. You know, being in radio for five decades, my favorite expression is, gee, technology's really great, comma, when it works. Because a lot of times it doesn't. And you spend a lot of your time trying to figure out what's going wrong now. But anyway, technology really is the driving force behind the United States economy. It really kicked into a whole new phase, starting with the tech revolution of the 80s and 90s. There were early indicators of it in the 70s. Remember when the new handheld calculators and programmable calculators came out? But really, 1980 is that benchmark point where the first personal computers appeared on the market. And 2017 is the 10th anniversary of the iPhone, which instead of just being a phone, which maybe could send a few text messages back and forth, as well as make phone calls, completely revamped how we see and hear things and communicate with each other. So how many changes, James, did the iPhone bring about?
You know, it's amazing, John, because with the introduction of the iPhone back in 2007, it really changed the phone. Phones were no longer devices that you simply made phone calls on. And imagine how big of a deal it was. I can remember seeing the first portable cell phone. It looked like more like it was a Motorola. It looked more like a walkie-talkie today. And how important it was where you could be anywhere and make a phone call and wouldn't have to be attached to some landline somewhere. But what happened with the introduction of the iPhone, our phones became remote, miniaturized computers. Now you could take a phone, and I can remember even this beginning with BlackBerry, they were used for email. Then they began being used with the iPhone for texting, for tweeting, and also it changed the way we communicate. And if you think about what the introduction of the iPhone is, the introduction of apps that allow us to travel. You no longer have to sit out in front of the airport or any place you're at. You can be at a restaurant at night or any social event. You could be at a concert and you don't have to hang out in front of the road and shag down a taxi car. You just get on your car and your Uber app, press a button. The next thing you know, a couple minutes later, an Uber driver is there picking you up and taking you where you need to go. And it also is used to book airlines. Airlines are using apps increasingly so that their customers can book plane flights. You don't have to get on your computer. You just get on an app, book your flight. It's done. Get your reservation. And it's all done with that simple device you hold in your hand. And if you think about not only just the way we communicate, think about entertainment. Everything from YouTube to iTunes, you do with your iPhone. And Apple itself began to basically phase out certain products it had. Remember when Steve Jobs first came out with the iPod, how that changed music. The first digital or MP3 player that became so popular, it became the must-have device to listen to music. Remember back when you had the old Sony devices that you used to put CDs in or cassette tapes in and strap them onto your arm? Well, now you could have this little device called an iPod and have thousands of different songs and music. But then eventually, what the heck did you need an iPod for when you had an iPhone? So it also changed the way we listen, download, and how we buy music.
You know, it's also destroyed a lot of landline usage, although I'm not totally giving up on that because I've noticed during emergencies, by the way, the cells go out pretty quickly after the batteries run down in the cell towers, which takes a couple of hours. But a lot of people are just relying on cell phones at home instead of, we have both here, landlines and cell phones. Or people are actually talking to us. A lot of our guests are on cell phones, or they're on some form of VoIP, voice over internet protocol, such as Vonage, which gives you the equivalence of a phone, but over your internet, or, you know, this Magic Jack or some of the other ones too as well. So the whole face of everything is changing. It's amazing that you can sit down and, let's say, for example, Skype. I sit down regularly and talk with people in Thailand or other parts of the world. And I think this is great. I'm not even paying for it, you know? Remember the old long international
minutes? Yeah, remember when you used to be real careful about making long distance phone calls because of the cost?
Because of the cost, yeah. And now everything is pretty much flat rate. to, you know, U.S., Canada, Mexico, places like that. You can get packages depending on what your carrier is. And even to Europe, you can buy package time, which is what we do for all of the guests that we have on the show. We buy package time for international calling. So, you know, it just completely changed the landscape. So that's a good part of it.
Well, it's a good part, and that technology has enabled us to do many things. I mean, smartphones really made possible, John, if you think about social media today, especially with President Trump and his tweeting, and how we get our news. I mean, you know, that's the thing about news today. Gone were the days in the late 70s and 80s where you'd come home from work, you'd turn on the network televisions. There were only three basic stations that you could watch, the three major networks, and you would find out what happened during the day. Is there anything that happens worldwide today in the financial markets, political event, any kind of event that isn't instantaneously known? I mean, when you come home from work at the end of the day, is there really anything you don't know that happened throughout the day, some kind of event, no matter what it is? And it also changed and threw upside down in a topsy-turvy world, the advertising world. Think about how it changed how we get our news, how we run political campaigns. But look what Barack Obama did to Mitt Romney and John McCain, and then take a look at what Donald Trump did to Hillary Clinton. It changed political campaigns. It also changed the advertising world. So today, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, WhatsApp, Instagram, Snapchat, all of these are garnering a larger and larger portion of our advertising dollar. In fact, 2015, advertising spending on mobile outdid print advertising for the first time in history. So that's just goes to show you how one device developed, became stronger, and became integrated into so many different things, disrupting everything from news, political campaigns, communication, advertising, digital photography, GPS, the hotel industry, the cab industry. It is changing and disrupting so many things that we do, and we have yet to begun, because the transformation that's going to take place in the next 10 years, we will not recognize many of the ways that we shop, what shopping malls will look like, what stores look like. We talked about this on an earlier program, but in the future, you may go to a store instead of seeing merchandise displayed and kept in inventory or out on display as you see in most stores today. You may go to a kiosk with a large screen, and you will go through screens and take a look at outfits that you're going to wear, a shirt you're going to buy, or a tie. And then what you'll do is you'll press a button, you'll pick them, and then you'll go into a virtual dressing room. You'll stand in front of this mirror with a camera, and then you'll press a device, and you will see what that item of clothing will look like on you. So everything that we are doing now and that is made possible in the last 10 years is going to change even further in the next 10 years.
You know, and you have to take a look at what happened to film, since Carol and I have a big background in broadcast and film and stuff. We used to buy 35 millimeter film in bulk rolls, 100-foot rolls, and we'd wind our own cassettes, you know, that had the film, because it was a lot cheaper to do that. And every time you were going to rack off a frame, you were careful. You said, I'm going to frame this shot, make sure it's right, because I'm paying for this. You know, I have to pay for the film, etc. Now, with the digital means we can have it instantly. And at the very same time we have it instantly, we can see not only what we got, we can transmit it somewhere. And if you don't like it, there's Mr. Delete Key. You know, you just hit the delete and say, I don't need that one. But now along comes the smartphones that we've seen, and they actually have some pretty high def res videos. And a lot of this is done away with the camcorders and related instruments and digital photography. But I will say this much, Jim, for those people who really still want to go out there and take good photos and really good HD video, they use the classic equipment. I know I do. But when I need a quickie, it's very easy to just whip out the phone, because it's got HD quality on it with gobs of megapixels, and you just hit the photo, and then you can transmit it somewhere, you know, when somebody needs to see it. Like, take a look at this.
Yeah, gone were the days where you had a camera and then you had to take it to the drugstore, the department store, to get it developed Today, you take the pick and boom, press a button, you send it off somewhere. And that's something the iPhone did away with. They really did away with and laid waste to digital photography. But as you point out, you know, the real high-end photography is still done with the digital camera. But digital photograph shipment sales fallen by 80% since 2010. And think of, you know, how you take photos today. Most photos aren't even printed. They're stored on your phone or a computer, they're tweeted, they're messaged, or posted on your Facebook page. So the way we treat photos are much different, the way we collect them. Gosh, I can remember growing up, raising our kids, taking pictures, and we've got photo albums, John, and we must have 10 or 15 of them when we were raising our kids. Now you can keep them all stored on a phone or your computer, and you can have thousands or a USB drive stick, and you can keep it. But it's not just digital cameras. It's also camcorders. I can remember when camcorders came out, going and taking pictures of my sons playing soccer or playing baseball. You know, what parent? Have you ever been to a kid's soccer game or baseball game? Everybody's out there with their cell phones, or you see it today in a news conference with the reporters. You don't have cameramen with big cameras over their shoulder. You got the reporters sticking out their iPhone or their Android phone out in front of wherever they're trying to interview, taking pictures. And take a look at the world of dating today has changed. There's all kinds of apps out there and programs for dating and meeting people. And if you really want to think about it, think about travel. How that revolutionized everything. I can remember getting into boating in the late 80s when we had used for navigation, especially coastal navigation, you would use something called LORAN, which was basically radio signals. Then all of a sudden they came out with SatNav, which was satellite, which eventually gave way to GPS. And then, of course, that eventually got put into cars. So people bought cars. You had GPS. You were taking a road trip. You take your present position, plug in the coordinates for where you wanted to go, and the GPS in your car would take you where you wanted to go. Well, with the iPhone, that all changed.
And if you're stupid enough to trust your GPS in your car, you deserve the fact of where you wind up, which may not be where you want to go, you know.
I'm trying to think of this was back when we were doing the San Francisco Gold shows, and a friend of mine and I were driving because I loved the drive up to San Francisco, and I had plugged in the hotel that we were to go in. The Gold show was at the Marriott, and I remember getting off the Bay Bridge. And John, it was taking me around. We ended up in like a dead-end street. I'm thinking, what's going on here? And I reprogrammed the address into my GPS, and it kept taking me to different locations. Finally, I had to call the concierge desk, and they had to direct me to the hotel because back then my GPS, I don't know what the heck was going on. But think about today. You know, you have Google Maps and it'll take you anywhere. But think what it did also to the GPS industry. Garmin was once the hot stock. You could pay $700-$800 for a GPS Garmin device. Well, you still pay that if you have a boat and you want to put it on a sailboat or a powerboat, you're still paying a fortune for that. But still today, for most people, a lot of people don't even get GPS in their car anymore. Why would you? If you have a cell phone, a Droid phone or iPhone, you just use Google Maps and it'll talk to you and tell you how to get there. So think of all the things that have come about with this one simple device and how this device may change as it keeps getting reinvented and redeveloped and improvements are made along the way. From changing the way we listen to music, changing the way we travel, changing the way we get our news, our entertainment. So many things have changed, and also the new industries it's given way to. I mean, think of Uber today or Airbnb, and also apps are going to be changing private jet travel. They are going to Uberize private jet travel just as they've Uberized cab fare, and that's coming.
Yes, I can just hear it right now. You know, turn right in 10 feet. Turn right. No, you missed it. Wait, go back. Stop. You missed the turn again. Are you naturally stupid or do you have to work at it? You know? I wonder if they've got them, some of them. That
no, unfortunately, they don't tech back.
No.
Please make a U-turn.
Yeah.
Please.
Oh, geez. No, I train millennials, you know, when I get a chance. I say, okay, the system just went down. Wham. You no longer have GPS and Google Maps. Tell me how to get from here to there. and work them through it. You know, you need backup skills. That's really an important, critical thing to have. Or when my son was doing his graduate work in Baton Rouge, you know, we got down there and I said to him, Troy, how do we get from here to return the rental truck? Or, well, I don't know. And he's zooming in and out on his smartphone. Well, I went into a Quick Stop, bought a paper map, spread it out on the hood of the car. And I said, now, this is something you can't do with your smartphone. You can get a complete overlay of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Notice where the streets go and how they change and what they do. Now we're going from here to there. And then you can use your GPS as a backup to that. But you should always have multiple methods of work. Well, anyway, where do you see us going in the area of technology, you know, over the next 10 years? Because I'm sort of excited about it.
I mean, there's a number of trends, and we don't have time to get all into them. But one will be AI and advanced machine learning. They call it deep learning technologies and neural networks in natural language processing. It could all encompass more advanced systems that basically understand, learn, predict, adapt, and potentially operate autonomously. Systems can learn and change future behavior. Intelligent apps, or what we call virtual personal assistants, are going to have potential to transform the workplace by making everyday tasks easier. I don't know about you, but imagine prioritizing your emails and text and the things that you get. The intelligent things, think of the way homes will be operating. We have a smart home. I mean, we control everything in our house with an iPhone or an iPad. I don't care if it's raising the blinds, turning the pool temperature on, controlling temperatures in the house, to entertainment devices from stereo all the way to television, all controlled with apps today. So homes will be run that way. They'll be run more efficiently. I mean, we have a solar powered home. I have an electric car, and all of it's being done with technology. And so think of the way we live, the way we drive, and also think so much of how the retail landscape will be. I mean, imagine, and it's rumored that the Amazon Echo is now coming up with a second version with a digital screen. But imagine, John, cooking dinner. You're in your kitchen, you're cooking dinner, and you're out of, I don't know, some kind of seasoning, or you need some kind of vegetable, or you need something. You turn to your Amazon Echo and you say, Alexa, I need olive oil. Half an hour later, a driverless car or drone shows up with a bottle of olive oil charged to your Amazon account. I was really shocked the other day. I went into Best Buy, and John, they had a whole aisle of drones. Drones with remote control, drones that had cameras on them, drones that had an LED screen on the remote control. And I was talking to the salesman. I said, you got to be kidding. What, these are selling? Because it's one of the hottest things we have. And if it was kind of scary in a bit, thinking that you could be sitting out in your backyard or skinny dipping in your pool and your next door neighbor has got a drone up in the air looking into your backyard. But yeah, drones delivering things to your doorstep or driverless cars. It sounds like fantasy, but it's just right around the corner because they're already building them and using them and test driving them. I was just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal about a shuttle bus that is driverless. And so they're already implementing this. Think about this way. It's kind of scary in a way, driverless highways. I don't know if I'm going to be into getting on an airplane with a pilotless airplane. I don't know if I'm ready for that. Are you, John?
Yeah, I haven't quite, you know, this always this, do computers ever make mistakes? And the answer is yes. And then is there someone to intervene in the event they do? They're pretty good. You know, I have no objection to call a lot of it now fly by wire anyway, because it's all computer control, you know.
Yeah, I thought of driverless cars and driverless airplanes, and I thought of the movie Scully, of the decision that he made. And remember, they tried to prove with computer simulation, it took them 18 times, but when they added a 30-second delay for decision-making by a human, it would have never made it. So
right.
I don't know if I'm ready to get on a pilotless plane, much less a driverless car. But nonetheless, they are coming, and I'm sure they'll figure it out. And I'm sure there'll be some mishaps and accidents along the way, but it is technology that's going to transform everything. You think the last 10 years and the iPhone has changed all the things we talked about? You've seen nothing yet that's coming your way in the next 10 years. I can tell you this, you will not recognize the retail establishment, the way you buy things, the way you're entertained, and the devices that are going to come to help improve your health. You think of the Apple Watch or the Fitbit or the different watches, you're going to have devices that you're going to wear that are going to monitor all your body vitals. It will store them and they'll transmit them. I don't know if you like this or not, but it'll transmit and basically diagnose you and then transmit it to a hospital or a doctor for a diagnosis. So, I mean, so many things are coming. I have a good cardiologist client and he says, just keep yourself healthy because the advances in heart medicine and taking care of hearts and people's heart disease in the next 5 or 6 years are going to be transformational. So a lot of things coming your way. And all of this is going to be disrupting everything from jobs. They're not going to stop automation, John. And that's why these silly politicians, every time they raise the minimum wage to $12, $15, more and more jobs will be automated. And it's not just blue collar jobs. It's also going to be white collar jobs that are going to continue to get automated away. It's just part of life and it's the way we're going.
You know, I love technology, but I've seen so much of it go astray that you think there's always got to be some human intervention somewhere. And yet we're even finding in trading, Jim, you know, things can happen faster than people can jump into it. Now, we may almost become spectators to our own demise at the right point. And you were right about the movie, you know, the movie with Tom Hanks about Sully and the Airbus that went into the Hudson River. They were trying to get him saying, well, on simulation, you know, we made it back to LaGuardia. We made it over to Newark. We made it. There was one other, I think, Teterboro. They made it over there. And that's right. You know, remember what he said in the movie? He says, well, okay, you've had your fun now. And then they try to act indignant. Well, what do you mean? He said, well, you guys all knew there was going to be an outage. We didn't. We didn't know we were going to lose both engines. And then there's this delay period in there where you have to figure out, okay, what just happened? Okay, can I restart? Is there a possibility to get one of the turbines restarted? If not, blah, blah, blah. And that chewed up that critical little piece of time that would have made turning back to LaGuardia possible. After that, there wasn't any choice but to put it in the river. And that's the human factor in there, you know? And do machines, do computers make corrective diagnostics better? That remains to be seen because there have been accidents caused by computers overriding their human supervisors. It was a Lufthansa crash, or it was more of an accident where they landing in bad wind conditions. And I remember the Lufthansa pilot saying, I knew exactly what needed to be done. And he said, I kept shoving in more rudder. And the computer kept saying, no, you don't want to do that. He's going, yes, I do. You know, and he said, I just watched the accident unfold right before my eyes. So it remains to be seen. Anyway, but technology is here to stay and we're going to live with it. And it is not going to stop progressing, as you said. All right. Speaking of the horizon, what are we seeing over the horizon on future programs?
Future programs, we are going to be full bore in earnings season. So we'll be watching corporate earnings, see what companies report. It was a very stellar first quarter, and analysts are predicting second quarter will go just as well. But more importantly, if it goes well, what will they be saying about Q3 and Q4? Because we are heading into fall, usually the more volatile periods of the market around September and October. And of course, we have the drama unfolding in Washington. Will we get tax reform? As Yellen urged, we need something. Will they repeal Obamacare? We don't know at this point because, well, here we are. We're into the second half of the year, and we don't have any of that legislation before us. And remember, the market has been moving forward on the basis that Obamacare would be repealed with something better because it's falling apart and imploding. We would also have tax reform and lower taxes. We would also have infrastructure spending. But the only thing the president's been able to do is deregulation, which is helping on the job front. But I don't know if that's going to be enough for the markets or the economy. All of that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.